Brett, why don't you set up the 75 minutes we spend here with Robert Venditti, filling everybody a little bit on who he is in case they're not familiar somehow with him, and they will be soon, and kind of what the experience was.
All right. Well, Robert Venditti is the current writer of Green Lantern, Demon Knights, and Exo Manowar. Demon Knights, of course, will be ending soon, but he's still a very busy guy. And he's written The Surrogates and Homeland Directive and Percy Jackson and the Olympians adaptations. I'm not forgetting it this time. But no, he's a super nice guy. And he was actually, the part that's unfortunate for everybody is they don't get a chance to see into his office like we did. He kind of took us on the guided tour of his office, which was awfully cool, but nobody else gets to see that.
No, but we do have him holding up one cool thing that's the picture for this show that everybody's going to get a chance to see. Yeah, no, again, usually you never know what to expect with a guy like this, a really, really nice guy, laid-back guy, easygoing, very funny, and I think everybody's going to really enjoy this. You never know what a writer is going to be like, but if you're looking for a dark, tortured soul, that's not Robert Venditti, and that's actually a good thing. I think everybody's going to really, really enjoy this, so let's kick off to it, Brett.
Sounds good. All right, welcome to We Talk Comics. This is Mo and Brett, and we're sitting down with Robert Venditti, writer of Exo Manowar, writer of Green Lantern, writer of Demon Knights, writer of The Surrogates, and Homeland Directive.
So we nail it all there?
Pretty much, yeah. The only other thing I've done is I also adapt the Percy Jackson, the Olympians novels. I make comics out of those as well.
That's right. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. But let's... let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back. I believe that the beginning is Surrogates.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you first started writing Surrogates, like when did you conceive the project?
I think I probably would have thought of it, you know, around 2002 is when everything kind of clicked in my head. But prior to that, in 2000, I was in grad school for creative writing at University of Central Florida. And we read a book called Cyber Gypsies. It was a true book, all about people addicted to the internet through chat rooms or online gaming or any of that kind of stuff. And it just had these stories about, you know, people that would lose their jobs or get divorced, or one guy even committed suicide because he lost his character in his game or whatever. And it was just an idea that kind of stuck with me. And I don't know what happened 2 years later that all of a sudden it became this idea for this story, but all of a sudden I just sort of thought, you know, what if, you know, what we use the internet for in a sense is to sort of, in a lot of ways, to tailor what people's views of us are. You know, you can use it to change gender or race or age or do any of these kinds of things. So what if you could do that and send this persona you created out into the real world instead of having it be bound to the computer, which you would necessarily have to surrender at some point to go to work or take your wife to dinner or whatever. Now, if the persona could go out into the world and live your life for you, you know, what would society be like in that environment? And, you know, this was all pre-Second Life, you know. I don't even know if Facebook was around then. If it was, I wasn't really aware of it. You know, this would have been like I say, 2002. So that's kind of where the idea all happened. But I don't know what happened to all of a sudden make me connect those two dots. You know, people ask me all the time, where do your ideas come from? And I wish I knew. It's just for some reason, all of a sudden there'll be something there where there wasn't something before, and you're off and running.
Was it originally intended as a comic book or a novel?
It was always going to be a comic. I was working in Top Shelf's warehouse at the time, which is where I got my start. I volunteered to pack boxes in Top Shelf's mailroom, which is a small press independent publisher here in Atlanta where I live. They publish Blankets and From Hell, and you know, they sort of discovered Jeff Lemire and Matt Kent and Jeffrey Brown and a lot of guys who are real familiar to mainstream writers now. They all got their start at Top Shelf. And I wrote the script while I was there, and I gave it to the publisher, and I said, you know, I know this isn't the kind of stuff you guys normally publish because it's much more of a mainstream full-color project, and Top Shelf does a lot more indie sort of black and white literary style of comics. But, you know, if you like it enough to introduce me to somebody that does publish this kind of material, I'd appreciate it. And the editor, Chris Staros, ended up reading it and liking it, and so they published it themselves, and it was the first sort of mainstream style of project that Top Shelf had ever done.
So how does Top Shelf work then? Because, I mean, how do they manage to attract all this great talent? They must have a really good eye.
Yeah, I mean, they do have a good brand that they've built over the years, and there are a lot of people that want to work with them, but Chris Starrs does have a really good eye, you know? I don't know. It's one of those things that he probably can't explain it either. He just knows it when he sees it, you know? He's looking for specific kinds of stories, not in a sense of content, but in the sense of how they're told, you know, with heart and that kind of stuff. And so, you know, Matt Kent, he got started at Top Shelf with a book called Pistol Whip that actually he drew and another guy named Jason Hall wrote. Jeffrey Brown got started with Clumsy over there. Jeff Lemire, Chris found him. I think Jeff Lemire handed him a copy of Lost Dogs, which was a book that Jeff Lemire had published after he won the Zurich Award. And that sort of caught Chris's eye. And then the first book that Jeff did with Top Shelf was Essex County. So, yeah, Chris just – he knows the kind of stuff he's looking for and the kind of people he wants to work with. Nate Powell is another one that he's brought on board that's really good. And he just has a good eye, you know.
That's fantastic. So tell us then, how long after Surrogates was published did it get optioned to be a movie?
Well, Chris bought it in 2002. It didn't get published, the first issue, until July of 2005. The complete edition, the first, you know, the collected trade came out in July of 2006, and it was optioned by August of that year. So it was pretty quickly.
How does that whole process work then?
You know, it probably works differently for everybody. You know, for me, there was a whole bunch of stuff that happened. You know, the first San Diego, when it came out, in the first issue in July 2005, I got approached by a bunch of, you know, sort of large, you know, brand name, if you will, producers. And we sort of divided up the town so that we had one person at Sony and one person at Universal and one person at Fox and one person at MGM or whatever. And they all went in and pitched it in the same week. And the idea is you're trying to get two more studios to compete against each other. And then your option price goes up. They all turned it down. All the studios turned it down. But then a year later, when the full book was finished, I got a call from a guy named Max Handelman, who has a production company called Brownstone Productions. Pitch Perfect is their most recent project. But at that point, they had never done a film. And he was just like a regular guy. You know, we talked on the phone about the NCAA tournament was going on at the time. So we talked about basketball and all kinds of stuff like that. And he was interested in the project. And even though he had never done a film, I liked him personally. And it didn't seem like it would be very, very cool of me, a guy who came from the warehouse and this was his first book, to all of a sudden say to some guy, oh, you haven't made a movie, I'm not going to go with you, you know? And so I talked to Chris and we ended up going with Max, and he ended up being the guy who got the ball rolling to get the film actually made. So, you know, it's kind of one of those things where everybody probably tunnels into the mountain their own way and dynamites a tunnel behind them, you know? And a lot of people will come up and ask me, how do I get a movie made? And again, you know, I don't know. It's different for everybody, you know?
Well, obviously, it's a movie that's you know, a major motion picture star gets attached to it, and so it's obviously a fair sized budget movie. Do you think it was going to be a smaller movie? Were you surprised at the size of the movie, the budget, the star, that type of thing? You know, or were you pretty quickly seeing that this was gaining momentum and just along for the ride?
Yeah, I mean, I knew nothing about Hollywood. I didn't know what to expect. I mean, to show you how little I knew, when I went and visited the set for the first time, it surprised me that they don't shoot the film in the order that you watch it on the screen. Like, that's how little I knew about film, right? So I didn't really know what to expect. I think the original plan with Max, because originally he was more of an independent-minded film producer, we were thinking it was going to be something smaller budget. But then he got Mandeville Films on board pretty soon, and they were a pretty big producer from Disney. And so at that point, I think they started looking at larger budget. But I never knew. I mean, I think it ended up being like an $80 million film. Like, I had no idea it was going to be like that, you know. As far as the star, you know, a funny story, which is 100% true. Back when I was writing it, before I even was published, and I don't know if you guys have heard the story or not, but I was talking to my wife, and comic book movies were first starting to become popular. Like, X-Men had done well. Spider-Man had done well. And if I remember right at that time, 30 Days a Night had gotten optioned, and it was like one of the first, like, outside the known brand name character success stories, you know? And so we were just talking, you know, if they made a movie out of this, you know, not any kind of rational discussion, just like a silly discussion, you know, if they made a movie out of this, who would be good in the lead role? And we both said Bruce Willis would be the perfect guy to play the lead because he can be a tough cop, but he can also be a vulnerable husband. And that's like a really integral part of the story. And so whatever it was, you know, 5 years later, I guess, they cast him in that role. And so it was pretty crazy.
Did you get an opportunity to meet him?
Oh, yeah, I met him when I went on the set. You know, one of the, you know, first day we walked onto the set, which was in Boston, so I visited a couple times. You know, one of the first things I did, it was in the middle of a scene, you know, in a, I don't even know what the thing is, it was in the middle of a cut, I guess, or whatever, I don't know. you know, they were shooting a scene. And so they
they're
say
making
cut.
A damn movie.
Say cut. What'd you say?
I said they're making a damn movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They said cut, and they brought us over to meet Bruce. And they introduced me and Brett Wellley to Bruce as you guys can call him Mr. Willis. I'm going to call him Bruce. They introduced me to Bruce as these are the guys. These guys are the reason we're all here, you know. And so I thought that was a really cool way for them to describe, you know, me and Brett Wellley being on the set, you know.
Yeah.
Are you happy with the way the movie turned out?
Oh, sure. I mean, obviously they made changes and I knew that going in, you know, and I like the book better, obviously, but that still doesn't really have any bearing on anything to me. You know, I mean, from the beginning, I never tried to insert myself in the process because I didn't want to be somebody who was managing somebody else's creativity. And the way I always tried to look at it is if I have a band and I make a song and you guys want to do a cover of my song, but I say, that's cool, but you have to make your song sound exactly like my song. Well, then, like, why would you want to do it, right? Obviously, you heard my song, and for whatever reason, inspired you to bring your creativity and what your band does to that material. And so I didn't ever want to be a guy who was managing that. So I was a consultant, and they would call me once in a while, and I was there as a resource if they needed me. But other than that, I just enjoyed the process and got out of the way. And another thing I think to consider is that it was an $80 million film. You know, so if Disney comes along and decides they want to pay $80 million to make a movie, I don't really feel like I'm in a position where I should tell them what they need to do to make their $80 million back. Like, if I want to make those decisions, I should pony up the $80 million. But you know what? I'm a little light right now. So Disney, why don't you spend the $80 million and whatever you got to do, you go do it, you know, and let the chips fall where they may. So
has there been any talk of adapting Flesh and Bone into a movie?
Not into a movie, you know, we've had some discussions about, you know, potential TV stuff or things like that, but I don't know. I mean, having been through the process and seeing how it works and seeing how long the odds are of those things actually coming to fruition and making it to the screen, it's not anything that I'd ever anticipate ever happening again. So, I'm just writing my comics and whatever happens, happens, you know?
Well, that's the thing. A lot of projects end up in development hell.
Sure.
You know, you're relatively speaking, for Hollywood's you know, point of view, your project was turned around fairly quickly into a motion picture. Say, was it 2006? It finished being published in 2009 and hit the screens.
Yeah, and it was extremely quick. And you know, it's funny. Again, everybody tunnels into the mountain their own way. Like I was saying earlier, the film would not have gotten made had it not been for the writer's strike that happened in 2007.
Really.
Like the screenplay for The Surrogates was turned in, or maybe it was 2008, whatever year that, I think it was 2007, whatever year the strike happened. I think it was 2007, yeah. Bruce Willis was supposed to go shoot an Oliver Stone film called Pinkville about the My Lai Massacre. The writer's strike happened, and that killed Pinkville because Oliver Stone's in the Writers Guild, and he does rewrites on set, so he wouldn't be able to make that film. So now Bruce Willis doesn't have a job. There's a limited number of screenplays that are already on the plate ready to go. Surrogates was one of them. Bruce Willis, like sci-fi, he ends up on Surrogates. Surrogates ends up getting made because there's nothing else to shoot because there's nothing else going on. So without the writer's strike, the movie probably would have never been made. And that's what I mean. Like people say, how do you get a movie made? And I'm like, you know, team up with a producer that's never made a movie and make sure there's a writer's strike. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what to tell you, you know?
Yeah, a lot of blind luck, I guess.
Yeah.
So have you got any more plans to write any more of the case files or any more surrogates?
Yeah, it was always intended to be three graphic novels, you know. And so the first one, The Surrogates, is book one. book two is Flesh and Bone, which is a prequel, and then book three would be a sequel that happens after Surrogates, and the whole thing would span about 30 years. And I know what the story is, you know. I mean, I've always known from the very beginning. It's just a matter of finding the time to sit down and doing it, you know.
Can you tell it to us right now, and we won't record it?
I could, but I'm not going to.
Oh.
But I promise.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure you do.
Well, let's move on then to Homeland Directive. If you say originally you conceived of Surrogates in 2002, and then, of course, 2006 is when it's finished. In 2009, when the movie comes out, of course, is when the second volume comes out. Homeland Directive is 2011. So there's a lot of space, actually, between that first time that you conceive of the first book and the time that Homeland Directive comes out. What was going on at that period?
Yeah, actually, I wrote Homeland Directive, and it was completely finished before – well, most of it was finished before Surrogates was ever even optioned. It's just the way the publishing schedule worked out at Top Shelf, it made more sense to fast-track Flesh and Bone and have that come out to coincide with the movie and then push Homeland Directive back. But I wrote all of Homeland Directive, and it was finished for at least a year before I ever even started on Flesh and Bone. So that's something I started working on in 2004. And I started it. I stopped it. I wrote a whole nother 5-chapter graphic novel that – it's still sitting in a drawer that I've never really done anything with. And then I went back and finished Homeland Directive after that.
Homeland Directive, of course, is more of a real-world setting than a science fiction setting or obviously a superhero setting. So if you're going to pitch that project to Hollywood, how would you do it?
You know, it's funny. Somebody, you know, a Hollywood guy came by and asked me that in San Diego once. And he was like, I was trying to explain to him. He was like, oh, so it's kind of like Bourne Identity. And I'm like, no, it's nothing like Bourne Identity. In my head, I'm like, dude, let him think it's like Bourne Identity. yeah, so my elevator pitch could use some work. But it's nothing like anything you've ever heard of is my elevator pitch now. You know, it's a political medical thriller, modern day conspiracy story. And the way I try to explain it is that it looks at this idea of this balance between personal privacy and public safety, which is something that's obviously hugely in the news right now with the NSA leaks and all these kinds of things. The program this guy's talking about, that's the NSA leak guy is talking about, is very much what I described in the Homeland Directive. Even though I didn't know that that program existed, that's kind of the program that I fictionalized in this book. And so I don't try to look at it from the perspective, though, of saying one is better than the other. I try to look at it from the perspective of we as a society, I think, kind of put our government in an unfair position where we demand both. And I think that's being evidenced by what's happening right now in the news. Like, we want our safety and we want our privacy. And when they impinge on our, when they infringe on our privacy, we rebel against that. But if we were to be attacked again, we would wonder why they hadn't kept us safe. And so we're very much a we want our cake and eat it too kind of country. And so how does government react when we give them this, you know, this scenario where they have to meet two mutually exclusive ends in a lot of ways because of the technology that we have now. And so that's the story that I tried to put together. I don't really try to make a statement about it one way or the other. I don't ever want my reader to know what I think about a topic. I just kind of want to present a question and let them decide what they think on their own.
Yeah, actually, that's what I was going to ask, is whether or not you try to put statements out about society, because certainly Surrogates has some, and Homeland Directive could be seen to have some. Like, if you are
sure they do, but even like something with Surrogates, I mean, I guess it's a social commentary, but I don't think by the time you get to the end of that story, I've had just as many people say to me, "You must really love technology," as people that say, "You must really hate technology." Like, I don't want people to know what I think about technology, you know? And with Homeland Directive, I have just as many people say, you must be like a right-wing, you know, guy. Or as people say, you must be a left-wing guy. Like, I don't want anybody knowing that, you know? I want that to be ambiguous, because I think that too often in our entertainment, whether it's film or TV or book or whatever, you know what the reader, what the writer is saying. You know what they think about these things. And then it becomes an exercise in them, you know, preaching to you. Like, if I wanted people to know my opinion, I'd be an essayist, and that's not what I am. I'm a fiction writer, so I think my opinion should remain, you know, private, so that my audience can read the book and come to their own conclusions and not feel like I'm trying to, you know, give them some kind of diatribe.
Does it become important to you then kind of explore different genres to try and express yourself differently then?
Yeah, that's very much a conscious decision that I made, you know. I wanted to do something completely different from Surrogates when I did Homeland Directive. And then after that, I did Percy Jackson books. I adapted a Blue Bloods novel, which is like a teen vampire romance story Then I did, you know, Exo Manowar. Now I'm doing Green Lantern. I've done Demon Knight. So with every project I take on, I think they're unique from everything else I've done before. And it's a way that I always try to challenge myself and get outside my comfort zone. You know, fantasy is always something that always really intimidated me and that I didn't know that I could do. And so when I came, when they came along with an offer to do Demon Knights, that's the reason to do it, right? And succeed or fail, you know, at least I'm trying to grow myself as a writer, and I'm always challenging myself with new things as opposed to just staying with what's familiar and, you know, maybe getting into a rut, you know?
Now, based on that, is the creative process of working with an artist different from Top Shelf and Valiant and DC, or is it kind of, is it individual to the artist, or is it kind of the editorial directive and different in that way, depending on the company you're working with, or?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've had, you know, very different experiences working with all the artists that I've done. You know, it generally tends to be the same. I've been fortunate that I've never worked with anybody that I didn't get along with, you know. Everybody's always been real professional. With Top Shelf, like, I had a hand in deciding who the artist was going to be. You know, we looked at samples and we looked at different people, and that's part of the reason why it took so long. You know, it was bought in 2002, but the first issue to come out in 2005 was because we were looking for an artist. With the mainstream publishers, a lot of times they'll tell you who the artist is going to be, and that's just the nature of it being a monthly book. And there isn't a lot of time to do an artist search. You know, they're putting people in. Or like with Demon Knights, I came on and Bernard was already the artist, you know. So a lot of times with the mainstream publishers, they'll pick somebody for you because they want the book to have a certain look, and it's their characters, and that's fine. But I, you know, the end result as far as the collaborative process generally ends up being the same.
Do you communicate through email generally, or do you talk on the phone or Skype?
Usually email. Email and text messages. Text messages.
Now, is it do you go and study with the artists, and you go and look at previous work to try and see their style? Do you adjust your writing style to, you know, kind of to suit what they may be good at or not good at, or anything like that? Or is it just kind of about telling the story the way you?
It depends on the project. You know, with the Surrogates and the Homeland Directive, both of those projects were completely finished before I knew who the artist was ever going to be. But yeah, you know, with the mainstream projects, you know, once I know who the artist is, I do try to write to what I think their strengths are, you know, or even more so to the content of the story, you know. Something like Demon Knights, you know, I has a higher panel count per page generally than like Exo Manowar does, you know. You know, for the most part, I don't know that my scripting style changes all that much.
Now, the only reason I ask is because Kerry Nord, who, of course, was working on EXO and then took a break, I guess, while he was moving to Toronto from where we are in Calgary. We met him a couple times, talked to him. Really good guy. But, you know, his style is quite different, say, in EXO than it is in Conan. So I don't know if that would you'd have to adjust your expectations or what's going on there. Or
yeah, I think with the Conan stuff, it wasn't inked. They just colored the pencils.
Okay.
And whereas in Exo Manowar, Stefano Gaudiano inked his first arc, and then the latest arc, the Planet Death arc, Kerry's actually inking himself, which I believe is the first time he's ever done that.
Oh, really?
Which is great. You know, he's trying to grow himself as an artist as well. You know, that's what I mean, always challenging yourself and things. Yeah, but I mean, in terms of that, like, I don't know that I adjusted my script accordingly to whether the art was inked or not inked. You know, I had read the Conan stuff because I was a Kurt Busiek fan, and so I came to the Conan stuff through that. And when Valiant told me that Kerry Nord was going to be the artist, which again, I had already written the first issue before I knew who the artist was going to be because of what their production schedule was and when they wanted the book to come out. When they told me it was going to be Kerry Nord, it was like almost like I had to go lay down. You know, I was like, whoa, you know, like this just got real, you know. Yeah. Because I remembered the way his stuff looked on Conan, and I went and pulled out all my, you know, back issues of Conan that I had from when he was working on it, and I started looking at them, and I started trimming down my panel counts. And I think you can tell from the earlier issues of Exo Manowar, the panel counts get less after I knew Kerry was on board and I was giving him the space to do these big epic things and that he does so well.
Yeah, he's certainly better better suited to those big epic moments, and I'm a really big fan of his own inking jobs. I think he's doing a great job with the new arc.
Yeah.
So how many comics then do you have? Like, because were you a comic book reader coming in, or did that kind of just, you know, morph along as you really got through the industry?
No, I read my first comic book in 2000, the year 2000, so I was in my late 20s. You know, for whatever reason, I didn't read them growing up. I have no idea why. But a friend of mine got me to read it, and as soon as he got me to read Astro City, and as soon as I read this arc
good
called
choice.
Yeah, I got to read this arc called Confession. Was the first thing I ever read. So the first comic book I ever read was Astro City Volume 2. I think it's number 4, the first issue of the Astro City of the Confession arc. Could be number 5. I can't exactly remember what the cover looks like. But anyhow, I read that, and then I read the rest of Astro City. And then I started reading – I went to the comic book shop where I was living at the time in Titusville, and everything was like Superman number 800 and Spider-Man number 9000 or whatever, and I didn't know where to start. And so there was this comic book cover that had a number 1 on it and had this really cool Alex Ross cover that I knew Alex Ross's stuff from covers of Astro City, and so that drew my eye. It was this really cool image of this guy with like a hammer like banging on an anvil, and it had like a real cool like oppressive, you know, mood to it or whatever. And it was Tom Strong number 1. So I was like, all right, cool. I picked that up and I read it and I really liked it. So I started reading these other ABC books that all started at the same time, like Promethea and Tomorrow Stories and Top 10. I was like, wow, this Alan Moore guy is pretty good. Like, what else has this guy written? You know? he wrote something called Watchmen. I'll go read that, you know? And that was literally how I found out who Alan Moore was. And so I started reading those kinds of stories and stuff like that. But, you know, as far as like Exo Man of War or even Green Lantern or whatever, you know, like I literally had never read when Warren called me, Warren Simons, executive editor of Valiant, he called me and asked me about pitching for their characters, not Exo specifically, but just their characters in general. I was like, man, I'll be honest with you. Not only have I never heard of any of those characters, I've never even heard of Valiant. Like, I don't even know who you are, you know, and because it was all the 90s stuff was all before my time, you know. But he was like, that's what we want. You know, that's what we're looking for. And so I used to think it would be a real hindrance for me that I wasn't real steeped in continuities of any characters or anything like that. But now I think that for better or for worse, it's maybe something that sets me apart from a lot of other people. And again, that might not always be a good thing, but at least maybe it makes my pitches different than what other pitches might be if I had been reading, you know, Green Lantern my whole life or whatever.
So then do you go and do a massive research project before you make a pitch, or do you just kind of try and get a kind of a, I don't know, a basic handle on the character and go from there? Yeah. What do you do?
I do more of a basic handle. Like for XO, I read the first 7 issues, actually the 0 and the first 6 issues, and then that was it. And then after I got the gig, I went and read the entire XO run. But I'm not going to go read 80 issues of comics for a job I may or may not get. You know, I mean, that's just too much time involvement. And so same thing with Green Lantern. You know, I read some things to get a familiarity with the character and did some research online to put together some concepts and the kind of guy I thought Hal was. But it wasn't until after I got the job that then I went and read, you know, I've read probably over 200 issues of Green Lantern stuff at this point. I've read all of Jeff's stuff. I've read a lot of Green Lantern Core. You know, that's a project where you're not going to go back and read it all, obviously. But I think I'm pretty well versed on the last 10 years or so, you know.
Okay, excellent. I have a lot of questions about what you just said there, getting into, you know, getting the project for Green Lantern and such, but just stick with EXO for a little bit longer. So they approached you about pitching for their product. Is that what you're saying? They approached you instead of the other way around?
Yeah, I mean, every time I've ever pitched for something, it's because a publisher reached out to me and said, you know, again, with Valiant, it wasn't EXO specific. It was just, you know, we're going to send you a bunch of stuff on a bunch of our characters and see which ones ring a bell for you. And EXO, again, was one that leapt out at me because it's like something I've never done before. I've never done just like a huge action style of story. And I wanted to see if I would be able to do that, you know, this sort of epic style of sci-fi. And in a lot of ways, EXO Man of War is a thing unto itself. I mean, there's really no other story like it where you've got a 5th century Visigoth in a futuristic suit of armor. Like, that does not exist anywhere. So for me, it was like, okay, that's a story I want to do because I'm never going to be able to do that story ever again. You know, similar thing with Demon Knights, you know, like when I read a few issues of Demon Knights to familiarize myself with that, to pitch for it, because they asked me originally to pitch like a 4-issue fill-in arc. You know, it had these characters like Exaristos and Horsewoman and Shining Knight. And I was like, I'm never going to get a chance to write any of these characters ever again. Like, this is my one shot, you know? And so I'm going to take this gig because this is never going to come along again. And there aren't any other characters like these, you know? And so, yeah, every instance of a work for hire thing, it's always been them coming to me and ask me to pitch, which I think is, you know, probably generally how it goes for everybody. You know, the publishers come to you. They get such a high volume of submissions from other people. I don't know how many of them they actually go with. I mean, maybe it's a lot. I don't know.
I don't know. They never come to me yet. I don't get it. But
what's wrong with that?
Yeah, come on. I'm right here. But
do you guys know Bruce Willis? Because that might
Mr. Willis, we call him.
Yeah. Mr. Willis. Yeah, we haven't met him yet.
So, but is there any other?
I don't want to make it sound like it was easy, though. I mean, I started out in the warehouse of Top Shelf Productions in 2002, and you know, DC called me for the first time in 2011. You know,
it does seem like it's been a meteoric rise since you basically got EXO. And you get EXO Manowar, I don't know if you're feeling a lot of pressure with EXO. I mean, it's the original relaunch of this Valiant. And even though you weren't familiar with it, it did have a lot of fans that were loyal, very, very loyal. Sure. Yeah, I mean, Valiant's
my EXO guy.
Right now, I think Valiant is the best publisher for me monthly, because I don't think Valiant has ever put out a single book that I wouldn't say was above average or better. I don't think they've ever wasted a single issue. There's never putting out a story just for the sake of a story. Everything has a point, and everything is very, very tight. And I really think they've done a fantastic job since they've relaunched.
But, yeah, I mean, they're doing an amazing job. I mean, for my money, Harbinger is the best book on the stands.
That's awesome. You know, I love Shadow.
I read Harbinger every month, and it's almost like I get depressed. You know, it's like Dice Art is playing chess, and I'm playing tic-tac-toe. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just a whole other level of thought and character development that he puts into his stories, you know? And I think a lot of that has to do with Warren, you know? He went out and he got talent that I don't think was obvious choices. I don't think anybody would have said, yeah, as a matter of fact, when they announced me doing EXO, everybody's response was pretty much, yes, Kerry Nord, and then who? Like, nobody.
I won't lie to you, that's exactly what I said on the podcast the day that in our news section it was announced. I went, Kerry, and who's that other guy?
Yeah.
I mean, I won't lie to you.
You know? I mean, it's kind of insane when you look back on it to think that they were like, yeah, let's take this guy that nobody's ever heard of and let him relaunch our whole company. Like, what kind of sense does that make, you know? But they just kind of knew the kind of storytellers that they wanted, you know? And I had never done anything commercial before in style of writing. You know, I had done, at that point, just Surrogates and Homeland Directive, really. And so Warren really showed me the ropes in terms of how to write a monthly serial and how to get readers oriented each issue and the basic principles of that style of storytelling, which is effort that a guy like that doesn't need, you know, like he's already got enough stuff on his plate. He doesn't want to have to hold somebody's hand and walk them through it. But, you know, he really did a lot of that for me. And I think, again, it was just they knew that they wanted Dice Art on Harbinger, and they knew that they wanted Fred Van Lente on Archer and Armstrong. They knew the guys that they wanted. And they went out and they got them. And I don't know, maybe that's why it worked.
Like I said, I love Shadow Man. Archer and Armstrong was pretty much my favorite series of 2012. I mean, it's just so good. Yeah, no, they've really done. Yeah. I think they've really done Terraria's work. But how long are you kind of scheduled to stay on EXO Manowar then, with your increased work schedule over at DC, and of course you've been building up to this Planet Death storyline, which, by the way, so far are loving. I'm hoping you're staying with that forever.
Archer and Armstrong, though, apparently. Maybe we should get Van Lente to write EXO, you know?
I'll tell you what, I like Planet Death more than any of those.
Well, you know,
well, there you go. See, I'll do the show for you now.
All right.
I'm not going to talk to
you. I'll be honest with you. Van Lente would do a great EXO.
He probably would. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, it's kind of the same, you know, with EXO and with Green Lantern. Like, you don't really come on board and you sign a contract for 24 issues or whatever. It's one of those things where you're on the story until you run out of ideas or they fire you, you know, like it's just kind of an open-ended deal, you know? So I have no idea. Like right now I know what the stories are all the way up through 22, you know, that doesn't mean there aren't any stories beyond that. There are, but I've already got it plotted out through 22, and then I know what I want to do beyond that as well. And it's just a matter of how long I'm able to keep it going, or how long Valiant decides they want me to be on the book, you know?
So obviously, you know, EXO in space, Green Lantern in space, that's what you're working towards for me, right? Give me a little,
an intercompany crossover.
Once the lawyers get all that ironed out, I'll be there for you.
Awesome.
You know?
Yeah. Right, you had a question there?
So you've got EXO plotted through 22. Is that typical for you? How far ahead do you typically plot?
Yeah, I'm pretty far ahead. You know, I'm just a pretty detailed guy by nature. you know, a lot of writers are stream of consciousness, and I really admire that, but I'm not the kind of guy who just sits down at a computer and starts typing. I really kind of need to know what my beginning, middle, and end are, and things can develop organically within that as I'm writing, but it's hard for me to sit down unless I have a plan. I won't start writing an arc until I know what that whole arc is, you know? Not because I don't want to. It's almost like I can't. You know, like I have to know what the whole arc is going to be before I'm able to start writing the beginning. So, yeah, I tend to plot things out pretty far in advance.
So I guess then by extension, how often, how many issues ahead do you write? I mean, I would assume that, like, obviously you've written out Demon Knights, but how many issues, say, of Green Lantern or XO have you got written now?
I'm about a month ahead on Green Lantern right now. I'd like to be 2 months ahead so that everybody else knows what I'm doing as the lead book. Not saying they have to follow what I'm doing, but just so that if anybody ever needs to be oriented in what's going on with storylines, I'm ahead of them and they can do that if they need that resource. They might not, but I want that to be available to them if they need it. With XO, it's harder because the production times on some of the books, I end up having to juggle arcs. So like I wrote issue 7 and then I wrote issue 9. And then I wrote issue 11, and then I wrote issue 8, and then I wrote issue 10, and then I wrote issue 12. And so that's an example where me being the kind of guy who plans things out and outlines arcs out way in advance really works out to my benefit, because if you come and tell me I got to write 12 when I haven't written 8 yet, I can do that because I already know what 8, 9, 10, 11 are because I've noted all that out. Whereas if I was a stream of consciousness guy, I would have to go write 12 and then have to reverse engineer it to get myself there. You know what I mean? So I'm not really that far ahead on XO, but that's because I'm usually doing more than one arc at a time, you know?
Would you have a plan then to maybe split Ninjak off into his own series or do another secondary series for them?
Oh, yeah, I would love to. They definitely have plans for Ninjak. I don't know if I'll end up being that guy. That's all up to them, you know? But, you know, when they came to me for the second arc and they're like, what do you think you could do with this Ninjak character? In my head, I was like, that is the dumbest sounding character I've ever
heard. We have a guy on the podcast, he's always bitching about Ninjak. He's like, it's a ninja in purple. What the hell?
But that's exactly right. And so what I said to Warren, again, you know, just challenging yourself to do different things. I was like, you know what? If I can write this arc and I can make Ninjak cool, I can do anything. Like, that's it. You know, I mean, that's like the white whale, you know? And so I had so much fun with that. And I think you even got the sense by the end of the arc, he was almost stealing the show,
yeah,
you know?
Totally.
Like when I got to issue 8, it was like, this is Ninjak's book now. And I didn't even care because I was like, the idea that Ninjak would ever come in and push XO to the back is so like absurd on its face that I just let him have his moment in the sun.
There was
like
a moment there where, you know, where I'm looking at it going, I want you to turn this into a buddy comedy book. Like I want another Archer and Armstrong. I want another Quantum and Woody. I want it with these two now.
Yeah. I really, really enjoyed that story. Yeah. And so, I think you can tell from the end of that arc, you know, that I leave it open-ended for ideas of what we could do with the character, but you know, it all depends. You know, Valiant is very methodical about their publishing plan and the order of the titles that they're releasing and the number that they're releasing and all that kind of stuff. So who knows when Ninjak's going to come
around. That's one of the reasons I really appreciate their work, though. I mean, that comes out. And as a reader, like I say, it comes out that I feel like I'm reading an organic universe that's taking part where all the pieces are connected, even if they aren't crossing over all the time.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
Well, and that's one of the biggest differences that I've noticed between this iteration of Valiant versus the last one is that the last one it got to a point where it was just, we're going to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. And this actually seems to very much have that strategy. And so absolutely, it looks to be working.
So I'm going to ask you this then, because you said XO was the guy when you had an opportunity to look at their characters. Obviously, you studied more than one character. Was there any other ones where you went, oh, you almost pitched instead or...
Yeah, I'll tell you the ones that I really, really liked were Shadow Man and Rye.
Yeah.
Like Rye, even today, I think Rye in a lot of ways is ahead of its time. You know, I mean, it's a really, really good story. And so those were the ones that I think
waiting for Rye to return. It's such a cool look to him, too.
Yeah, yeah. So those are the ones that are the biggest, probably struck the biggest chord for me.
Any plans on any foil covers, special looking things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you
we have one talk. Is that not good enough for you? We have a very first talking comic book cover, you know? No, I don't know. I mean, that's all up to you know, marketing and those guys. I mean, I don't know what their cover plans are.
Yeah, I'm just realizing you missed that whole era. I guess.
I did. Yeah.
Covers. I mean, you get that XO0 with that. What was that? A chrome lenticular cover or something crazy? Yeah. I mean, it was.
I was lucky to miss all that. Although I think a lot of that stuff is kind of coming back around right now, you know, being more creative with it. But I missed all that. The whole speculator craze, that was all before my time, you know.
Well, okay, let's move on to Demon Knights here, if you don't mind. You come into the book and you're taking. Was it Paul Connell who was writing the book previously?
Cornell.
Yeah. Okay, my mistake. Paul Cornell. So
not only just writing the book, but he launched that book.
Launched it, yes.
And so that concept of, you know, this, you know, superpowered team in the Middle Ages and a lot of those characters I was mentioning before, Ex-Aristos and Horsewoman and Aljabbar's another one, those are all characters he created specifically for the series. So he was much more than just a writer. He was a creator in a lot of ways.
So do you have any sort of conversations with him about taking over the characters and trying to familiarize yourself with them and trying to have an idea of where he was going to go but take your own way? Or how do you go about this?
Yeah, I mean, he was very cool about me coming in and taking over because he was leaving the book. It wasn't like he got pushed out or anything. And I mean, he was just so open and generous about introducing me to the readership. And, you know, he let me write a blog post for his website to introduce myself to his readers and things. But he never wanted to know what I was going to do with the story because he wanted to read it month to month and be surprised by it. So we never really got into talking story or anything like that. Everything I got in terms of plot threads and characters and stuff, I got just from reading the issues that he had done.
So now, given some of the challenges of the book, like, would you say that you kind of went in with that, like, you know, I really want to try to, you know, push this book and really drive it places that nobody's ever seen?
What do you mean by challenges?
Well, I just mean, like, given it had a slightly lower sales number and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I knew going in that it was going to be, you know, month to month. You never knew what was going to happen. And I think a lot of people would probably say career-wise, you know, like, why would you take a project on like that? And it's unfortunate because niche titles are just hard, you know. I mean, it's a quality book, you know, but niche titles are just hard. And I think a lot of people say, you know, why would you go in taking on a title knowing that it might get canceled? And to me, like, that's the reason to go take it on, right? Because, again, I'm never going to get to write Etrigan again. I'm never going to get to write Vandal Savage again or Shining Knight or any of those other characters. So the time is now. Like, if I want to check those people off my list and be sitting in a room and people seeing, like, yeah, I worked on this character and this character, and me being like, do you ever write Shining Knight and Vandal Savage? And they'd be like, no, I never have, you know? So to me, that's the reason to go in and do the book, is because the ship is sailing and you either get on it or you're left standing on the dock, you know?
Yeah, two questions then, both about Etrigan. Number one, is it easy to want to make him simply take over the book? I mean, he's a very popular, powerful, well-known character,
sure.
A big personality. How do you balance that out?
Yeah, I mean, actually, with my first couple of issues, I made a conscious effort. Like, the first 40 pages of Demon Knights I wrote, he appears on one page. That's like the first page of the second issue, and that's it. Because of the plot line that I put together where he was sort of trapped in Jason's body and Jason's mouth had been removed and so he couldn't conjure the demon. And I did that because I wanted to focus on all the female characters. And so, again, challenging myself. I've never written a teen book before Demon Knights. I've never written a female cast before. So I wanted to come in and say, you know, can I write a good story with three female characters and make the entire book about the female cast saving the most popular, recognizable male character by defeating the second most popular, recognizable male character. You know what I mean? Like, that was a very conscious decision on my part to try and do that. So, you know, I don't have a hard time balancing him against the other characters in the book, probably because in a lot of ways I find the other characters more interesting.
Oh, you know? Well, what about if you made him rhyme? That's my other thing. Come on, Etrigan's supposed to be rhyming.
Yeah. The way that they sort of concepted him out in the New 52 is that he rhymes when he needs, like, something really strong and powerful, but he doesn't rhyme all the time.
You know? Yeah, I can only
as a writer, is that better for you, or do you just wish, God, I wish I could just make him rhyme all the time?
Yeah, it would have been fine either way. You know,
it's fun.
I would have, Yeah, I would have had him rhyme either way. Either way, it would have been fine.
I can only imagine just being there, like, please don't make him rhyme. I don't want to rhyme.
No, it wouldn't have bothered me. Again, it's another challenge, you know. And I think that in a lot of ways, it goes to the idea of constraints. You know, like there's a big debate right now going on, creator-owned versus work for hire, and some people say one is the best, and other people say the other is the best. You know, but I say there's benefits to both, because with creator-owned, something like Surrogates or Homeland Directive, I can do whatever I want. You know, and that's one kind of creativity. I'm making these stories up, and I'm doing whatever I want. It's a blank canvas. But when you're doing something work for hire, you're operating within a set of constraints. You know, this is a super team in the Middle Ages or whatever have you. And once you have constraints, that opens up a whole other kind of creativity, because now you're trying to figure out how to put puzzle pieces together, and you're being given half the story and you're figuring out the other half. And so to me, you know, that's part of the fun. So for them to say, you got to make Etrigan rhyme all the time, that would have been another constraint that would have bred to probably some other creative ideas, you know?
You know, it's funny because I think a lot of people, when they're looking at Green Lantern before Geoff Johns took over, there was kind of a viewpoint that Green Lantern, rightly or wrongly, needed to be fixed. And there's also the viewpoint now that he's leaving it that nothing needs to be fixed. So that presents a whole, perhaps, new set of challenges.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that, yeah, it's a pretty enormous challenge just to follow Jeff, honestly.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, those are pretty tremendous shoes. And again, there were a lot of people who said, you know, don't take it. You know, don't take the job. No matter what you do, people are going to hate it. And to me, it's like I'd rather be the guy who knows he took his shot than the guy wondering what if. You know what I mean? And so I'm going to go ahead and give it a shot. I'm not going to try to outdo Jeff, and I'm not going to try to fill his shoes or whatever, because in a lot of ways those shoes can't be filled. I'm just going to come in and tell the kind of stories I like to tell the way I know how to tell them, and hope that people like them. And it's not about trying to fix things, you know, or anything like that. It's about taking this great mythology that he built over this very long run and telling stories with it and being able to play in that sandbox, you know?
So it's not necessarily a sense of intimidation. There's a sense of excitement with what he's left you.
Very much so. Yeah. I mean, and there is a lot of pressure on it too. I mean, don't mistake that, but I mean, that is what it is, you know? I don't know.
I'll give you this.
I can just imagine somebody saying someday to me, you know, me telling them I had a chance to write Green Lantern and not taking it, and then punching me in the face. You know, it's like, that's insane. Like, literally, that gig had not come along in 10 years.
Well, Mr.
You know,
Venditti,
10 years.
You're like Mr. Willis to me, Mr. Venditti. I'll say this. My father once told me that you are better for making a mistake because you're trying too hard than make the mistake and never trying at all. And,
sure,
and it's like,
yeah,
you know, I think that's a good way to look at it. So, I mean, you have this great universe to play with then. Are you going to tell us, say, your next 20 issues plotted here?
Not 20, but I am plotted out. Let's see. I think I'm plotted out up to about 30 right now. So that's
good.
You know, 8 issues ahead of where we are.
So now earlier you talked about wanting to be a little more ahead so that everybody else could kind of see where you were going with it. Now, is it going to tie in with the other books at all? Because I noticed that you're co-plotting on Green Lantern Corps. And also, what does that entail for you? But, you know, I'm just interested in how much crossover there'll be.
Yeah, the books are going to definitely have common threads running through them. Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps probably the most, just because of the idea that Hal is now the leader of the Corps, and that's kind of this conflict that he's dealing with now. And so necessarily that puts him on Oa a lot of the time. But the books will all also stand on their own as well, you know. I think it'll be the kind of thing where sometimes they'll come together for a little bit and then they'll go their own ways, and then they'll come together for a little bit and that kind of stuff. In terms of me co-plotting on Corps, I mean, that's really just a function of me sort of, you know, working with Dan Jennings, a buddy of mine, and we come up with concepts together and things like that. And then he does all the scripting and all the dialogue and all that kind of stuff. I don't do any of the actual writing. I just sort of plot out the stories with him, and then he takes it from there. He's a super talented guy. You know, I think if you read his first issue of Green Lantern Corps, you could see that. I mean, that's the first issue of a monthly comic that guy's ever written in his entire life. You know,
wow.
I mean, it's pretty crazy when you read it and you realize that. So, you know, it's more just breaking down stories and thinking about where things are going to go, and then him taking it from there and putting his own spin on things, you know.
So then, let's see now. What characters are you really interested in? Like, you've talked a lot about like, you know, Shining Knight and stuff like that that you might never get to write. Who are the characters that are kind of on your bucket list?
Yeah, you know, like, I don't know because I've never read any of them. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't grow up reading comics, so there's probably like a million characters out there that I would think are totally awesome that I know nothing about, you know? I know about all the main characters like Spider-Man and Batman and Superman and all that stuff. I know about them what everybody else knows through general pop culture knowledge, whether it's the films or cartoons or whatever have you, you know? So, I mean, I do like those characters. I like Superman. I like Batman. You know, but I don't know that I have a bucket list because I think there's so many characters out there like Shining Knight or Vandal Savage or any of those characters that I've never heard of until somebody says, do you want to write Demon Knights? That's really exciting. Like, you read this character, you read XO and you go, holy cow, look at this concept. This is such a great high concept. I'd love to be able to do something with this. I think that's kind of more the way it is, you know?
So then how much leeway have you got to put in characters, like different characters that you want to work with into Green Lantern, say?
Like introducing new characters?
Yeah, or introducing new characters or just introducing
or using other
characters to the story.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I mean, they haven't said no to anything yet, you know? And
Introduce X-Men Manowar.
That they would say no to. The first sort of long arc that we're doing, which will be over by end of October, it's a really sort of risky, ambitious story that we're coming out of the gate with. And DC's been really great and really supportive about, you know, wanting to take chances and to do some things like that. And so I haven't had any problems at all. And you know, they've announced this Villain Month issue for DC with this character called Relic. That's an entirely new character that I created to be the antagonist of this first, you know, arc that I'm talking about that'll go through October. And, you know, I think maybe of all the Villain Month issues, there's only two or three that are new characters, you know? So I think they've given me a lot of leeway. I'm very happy with how things are going so far.
You know, it's almost like you're being paid to play with other people's toys. But back to kind of when you're taking over the book, they came to you. You say again when they're offering, you know, what would you do with Green Lantern? Do you talk much with Geoff Johns? Did you get really close with him the last few months? Go, come on, yeah, this will get me the job. I'll become his best friend. And
no.
What's kind of the process there for getting the job at Green Lantern?
No, I mean, I didn't really do any of that. I mean, I've met Geoff and I've talked to him. He's a super nice guy. But I can only imagine what it must feel like to be on a book like he was for 9 years or whatever it was. And to create this entire mythology from the ground up, to do all the things that he did, and to come to that day where he's got to walk away from it, you know? I didn't ever want to reach out to him and be like, hey, buddy, help me fill your shoes. You know what I mean? Like, he's earned the right to just make his own exit, you know, and not have, you know, the young whippersnapper, you know, bugging him with emails and crap. You know what I mean? And so, I mean, he's a great resource, and if I ever have questions, he's there. But I tried to be very respectful of what I can't even imagine he must have been going through. You know, I mean, I don't want to leave XO, and I've only been on it for 14 issues, you know, and I can imagine what it will feel like if somebody else came in and wrote XO, because I was the only guy that's written it so far, you know, so I can't imagine what that would be like over the course of 9 years, you know.
Well, we're cheering for you to reach 9 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate it.
Now, again, we are taking.
And I will say this, your readers won't be able to see this. But you can see it.
Excellent. I love being able to see things.
Sitting on my desk.
Oh, that's awesome. Holy crap.
The day the Green Lantern – wait, this ain't even the whole deal yet, buddy.
Wow.
You gotta get the grand finale here.
Oh, that is fantastic. Oh, my God. It lights up.
You put on the ring, and when you touch the ring, it lights up.
Oh, that is fantastic.
But like the day Green Lantern 20 came out.
You say our listeners can't see this, but you mind holding that up and doing that again, Brett, and maybe just hit a print screen, if you wouldn't mind, for us to use on the show. And would you mind putting your ring back in and doing it that way again?
It's kind of hard because it's –
It's 700 pounds? That would be awesome. Okay. That is great. Thank you, sir. That's That's a great picture.
Well, I decided, you know, since nobody can see it, but I decided to wear my own Green Lantern shirt today. So.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, but on the day that Green Lantern 20 was in stores, I got a FedEx box with that on my door, time to arrive on that day, and it had that in it and it had a note from Jeff that said, "Welcome to the Corps."
That's, you know, awesome. What a good
So
guy.
That's the kind of guy he is.
That's, you know, a fantastic story. That's a fantastic story. So, you know, you're talking about all these characters. How familiar are you with the characters over at Marvel?
Not at all.
Not at all, know? Again.
I mean, just like I say, what I know about Spider-Man or the Avengers through, you know, film and stuff like that.
Do you read many books? Do you collect many books monthly? Or is it just kind of you concentrate on what you have to do for your job and that's plenty? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I don't get to read as much as I'd like to, you know. I read Mind Management. I read
awesome.
Six Gun, you know. Awesome. But I don't get to read as many comics as I would want to, you know. Just it's a time thing more than anything else.
Well, yeah, I mean, with you having been writing three books here right now, it's...
Yeah, and I've got, you know, creator-owned stuff going on, too, that hasn't been announced yet. But I've been working on probably the biggest creator-owned project I've ever undertaken in my career. I've been working on that for a while. So
is that also, you know, looking to be published through Top Shelf? Or?
I'll have an announcement about that pretty soon.
Okay. Yeah. All right. You feel free and text us first. And, yep. You know, we'll be happy to put that announcement
more
up
than
you.
Happy to
we'll do it for you.
That's right. And so can we make requests on characters?
in Green Lantern?
Yeah,
it'd probably be a better talking to Van about that, because he's going to have most of them in core. But what do you got?
Well, actually, I just want you to reintroduce the Golden Age Sandman. I don't even care where he fits in, but just bring him back for me.
That's... I want you to reintroduce Goldface.
I'll see what,
do you know Goldface?
I'll see what I can do for you. Yeah.
Are you familiar with Goldface?
I have no idea.
That's what, at one point in time, that was probably ahead of Sinestro, even. I'd say was arguably the number one villain for Hal Jordan. Of course, because he was all gold, and at the time, yellow wouldn't work. But, of course, they've got rid of that, so the character has almost no place again. So to reinvigorate him to the point where he's, again, a dangerous villain, given that his whole power that made him so dangerous taken away would be... I'm just throwing this out there for you. I'm just planting some seeds.
Just say, man, just a couple of guys talking.
You can use it.
Wait, that's right. Writers hate that.
Yeah, of course you would. You can do it better than me. Don't worry about it. How about since he's a member, Hal Jordan, of course, in the Green Lantern Corps and all this stuff, and you got all these different Lantern books in this own section of the DC Universe, but it's also, of course, he's a member of the Justice League. So what kind of – is there any sort of mandate from DC about what's happening with Justice League and any sort of crossover? Is it completely separate?
Yeah, not right now, you know, because Boz is the Green Lantern over there right now. So Hal's, you know, pretty much not on Earth. So there hasn't really been any, you know, crossover with that kind of stuff.
You don't have to really worry about it at all.
Not right at the moment, no. Yeah.
That's another thing. What about intercompany crossovers? You haven't really had to deal with this massive crossover yet. Are you looking forward to the challenge of something like that? Is it?
You mean like a Blackest Night kind of thing,
like
where everybody's on board?
Yeah, you know, or what happens at Marvel every day with a massive crossover with every single book crossover?
Yeah,
artist.
I mean, I've never been a part of that. So again, it would be a challenge. It'd be something I'd never done before. You know. So yeah, that'd be fine with me. You know, I'm sure that day will come. You know?
It will come.
Yeah, it's comics. It's bound to come.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know. Do you have any other questions, Brett? I think we've taken plenty of your time. I think you've answered. I think you've answered everything we had on our list, and probably a little more.
About 100 more. Yep.
Yeah. So we really appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, why don't you plug your stuff? Plug all your social media, anything you want to plug. This is your chance.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty easy. I'm just my website is robertvendetti.com, and then I'm on Twitter at Robert Vendetti. I don't have Facebook, MySpace, any of that kind of stuff. So
that's fine. Well, that's fine.
Easy.
Well, I remember when it was announced you were taking over Green Lantern. I was on Twitter, and you know, I was just saying how good a job and how excited I was for it and how good a job you had done at EXO. And you kind of at some point saw me on there and you said, what is that? Are you making a prediction that I'm, that I'm going to be, that I'm, that this is too much for me, or I don't know if you were teasing with me, but we have. I hope so. Great confidence in what you're going to do coming up here, and you say it's you're coming out of the gate with a big, big story. I think actually here one last question, if you don't mind.
Because, I got time, man. Whatever.
Yeah, I do think this is something that's. How would you describe your writing style differently from Geoff Johns? Because he's somebody who seemed to go from big, huge event to big, huge event. And you're somebody who we kind of see kind of, from what I've seen, you kind of characterization, slowly building plot points towards a big event, but not necessarily something quite the, he's a very breakneck speed to how he's doing his books.
Gosh, I never really thought about that. I'm not really sure. I mean, I think that with something like Green Lantern, you know, those sort of big, huge epic storylines are kind of just part and parcel of what the stories are going to be, you know? So I definitely have similar goals along those lines. But I think it's more just a sense of just introducing different challenges, you know, like making Hal leader of the Corps, which is something that it makes sense that he would become leader of the Corps because he's the guy who is, you know, led the Corps to triumph through all these massive events. But again, that's something that's kind of goes against his character to be a leader. He's more of a lone wolf, you know, test pilot in the cockpit kind of guy. So I think it's just the idea of introducing different challenges and seeing how he reacts to them is what's going to make the stories different as opposed to any sort of, you know, Geoff comes up with the challenges he comes up with and I come up with the challenges I come up with. And I think it's all about sort of this idea that just like Grandma said, we're all unique little snowflakes, right? And so to the extent that you can put your snowflakiness into your story, that's what's going to make your Green Lantern story different from somebody else's Green Lantern story, different from somebody else's Green Lantern story, because ultimately there's only a certain number of Green Lantern stories out there in the world, right? So the only way you're going to get to make your story different from anybody else's is to, you know, infuse it with your influences and your experiences and the things that interest you as opposed to trying to imitate, you know, what somebody else is doing. And I think that that's where the differences in the storytelling come.
Well, he just created two follow-up questions. See, that's what you get for talking and being so eloquent. Number one, you know, I mean, I think it's probably completely unfair, but when you have somebody like Geoff Johns who's been on a book for 9 years and has done, in many ways, the definitive Green Lantern run for his generation, mm-hmm. No matter what you do, there's people who went... As soon as they heard Geoff Johns is leaving, they're going to leave. A lot of people stick around and see what you do, but a lot of people will leave no matter what just because he's left and they're fans, such fans of his. So how do you kind of, I mean, does that play on your mind? Or you just, you know, carry on and do your own thing? You seem like the type of guy who just carry on and do your own thing.
Yeah, I mean, all I can do is do what I do. You know, I have no control over that, and I think you're right. I mean, for a lot of people, the only Green Lantern they've ever read in their entire life is Geoff Johns' Green Lantern, you know, because he put together that kind of long run on the title. And, yeah, sure, that's going to happen. And I guess all I can do is try to get those readers back or try to get new readers or whatever have you. But, you know, hopefully most of the people will give us a shot. And I think they'll see that I'm not, you know, destroying everything that Geoff built. You know, that's not my goal, to come in and break everything down. He put together this great mythology, and the fun of taking on the project is to work within that. And so, but yeah, that's obviously going to happen, you know. Not only is he so identified with Green Lantern, but just as a brand, he's a much bigger name than I am. You know what I mean? And again, you know, 14 issues of Exo Man of War ago, you had no idea who I was, you know? So that's definitely a big hill to climb, but we'll give it a shot, you know?
Absolutely. And how long before you take a character on like this, before you kind of think to yourself, you're starting to feel the character? How quickly is it different for every character? Do you kind of have an idea after a certain amount of time and that you go, okay, I'm starting to understand the skin of this character? I mean, obviously the personality of someone like Eric in Exo Manowar, and how is mm-hmm. that pronounced? Arik? Eric? How do you pronounce it?
Yeah, I say it both ways. I think technically it's Arik, but I say Eric just as many times.
Yeah. Well, Arik, you know, his personality is very different from Hal Jordan. So how long does it take you before you kind of start to feel the personality?
Yeah, I think it's different in every instance, but with Green Lantern, I really feel like I start to know Hal with 23, which is a August issue. I'm really happy with the way that issue came out, and I feel like I really started to spend some time with him as a character and really start to figure out what makes him tick in certain ways. But in a lot of ways, it's a never-ending process. You know, you're always discovering new things about your character. And some of the most exciting moments when you're writing a story is when your character does something. And for just like that one brief moment, it's almost like they wrote themselves. And it only happens for like 5 seconds, you know. But for like one line of dialogue or one scene or whatever, they write themselves. And then you'll spend the next year trying to make that happen again, you know. And it's those little quick moments are what keep you going as a writer, because those are the moments when stories really feel like they're alive, you know.
And one of the things that I think was very intriguing for me on your first issue was the relationship you had between Hal Jordan and Carol Ferris. So mm-hmm. I'm sure you don't want to give away too much, but kind of how do you see their relationship?
Yeah, I think a lot of people read that scene, especially in light of Green Lantern 20, where they're shown, you know, at this point in the future, you know, which, you know, to me, from my perspective, what we were shown in Green Lantern 20 is not some unassailable vision of the future. We were told what happens in the future as recorded in the Book of Oa, which we're told in that very same scene as missing pages that were burned because they don't want anybody to know what's happening with Sinestro. So to my mind, just like any book of history, whether it's the book you had in high school or whatever, it was written by somebody, and that somebody had an agenda. You know, whether that agenda is good or bad or whatever, there was an agenda behind that. So that's not necessarily the unassailable future that's going to happen for all these characters. But I think a lot of people read what the future was for Hal and Carol at the end of 20, and then they saw what I did in 21, and they think I'm going to go back and just sort of do this will they or won't they thing. And I think if you stick with the Green Lantern story, you're going to see that Carol's going to play a much different role in that than I think people are expecting.
Nice. We're all really looking forward to it. So this time I think we are done, unless you have any more questions, Brett.
Well, I mostly have a comment. After you agreed to come on the show, which, again, we totally appreciate, I really went back and I read a lot of your work. And the number one thing that I will say is that I'm really glad that I read Surrogates, because I think it's one of my favorite works now. And I think that it's one of those cases where I think everybody else should read it too, just because I really enjoyed reading it. And I thank you for that.
Yeah, I was already a fan. He shoehorned in on my interview.
Well, I appreciate that, man. I'm still extremely proud of that book, you know. I think I'll always will be. You know, I don't know. It's very humbling to be able to be in a warehouse packing boxes and to have something like that be your first book, and to have Top Shelf be so cool about letting me do the supplemental material and to have them put their faith in me, and to then let the book actually, you know, come out and to have it become a film and all these things happen with it, you know, it's really pretty crazy. And so, you know, I did a tour in Europe. Probably the coolest moment I had of the Surrogates was I went on a 3-week book tour in Europe to promote various foreign language editions. And at one point I was in France and I was in a restaurant, which was a really high-end restaurant, on the top floor of the tallest building in Paris. And I did an all-day interview session where I just sat in this room, and TV and newspaper and magazine and everybody came in and just interviewed me and Brett over and over and over. And we broke for lunch and I'm sitting there looking out the window and it's like, there's the Eiffel Tower. I'd never been out of America, you know. There's the Eiffel Tower and there's, you know, the arch that they rode through on the tanks when the Americans liberated Paris and all that stuff. And it's just like, how did I get here? You know, I mean, it's just, it's so unbelievable to think, or, you know, one of the things I have on my wall in my office, which you can't see because it's off camera right now, is the Russian movie poster of the Surrogates. And like, I grew up in South Florida in the 80s, you know, during the Cold War. My parents were in Florida during the Cuba Missile Crisis. Like, the idea that someday I would grow up and write a book and it would be on a movie screen in Russia and the poster would be written in Cyrillic and whatever have you, like, these are unfathomable things, you know. And so it's just, like I say, it's humbling, and I don't deserve it any more than any other guy does. A lot of it is right place, right time, but, you know, what do you say? You know, I mean, if nothing else happens from here and I go to dig in ditches for the rest of my life, I've done these things and nobody can take that stuff away from me.
All right, you know? So you just created 2 more questions. number one, How about the fact, idea that you could, if you could go back and look at some of your prior works, even say early Man of War, one of these other books, would you go, oh man, I could rewrite that a little better. I could do this a little better because you're a better writer now and you're more experienced.
Yeah. I mean, I never get done revising, you know. There's this famous story, Gore Vidal, who is an essayist, has a story that he told about Truman Capote, and they were good friends. And he goes to see Truman, and Truman is at his typewriter, and he's revising a story. And it was a story that had already been published. It's already in print. And Gore Vidal was like, why, you know, what are you working on that story for? It's already been published. And Truman Capote said, it isn't finished yet, you know? And I think that's the way it is for all writers. Like, you always want to go back and fix things and change things. And you could revise something for the rest of your life and never actually put it out in the world. But at some point, you just got to let it go and put it out there for better or worse. Or you're never going to grow as a writer, and you're never going to get to the point where you get over that hump to where people are actually reading your stories and you're sharing them with the world. And so, yeah, there's certainly things I'd like to go back and do differently about Surrogates or Homeland Directive or Flesh and Bone is probably my favorite story that I've written to date. It's the one that I think came together the best, you know, at least in terms of my creator-owned stuff. And you always want to go back and fix those things. And certainly with monthly comics, I mean, it gets to a point where this, at 28 days, the book's got to go. You know, whether it's done or it's not done, 28 days, the book's got to go. And so there's always things that you want to go back and fix about that stuff. But I think that's just the nature of being a writer or any artist, really. You know, you're never going to be completely satisfied with the things you've done. And in the moment that you are completely satisfied with the things you've done, that's the moment that you stop growing and you should be scared. And like, if you're ever in a room, and I came across a lot of these guys in grad school where I was this writer who would turn in stories and just, I would get workshopped mercilessly, like insulting, berating comments about my stories from all these people and all these other writers in my classes who obviously had this writing stuff already all figured out. And it was just a matter of time before the world discovered their genius because they had been birthed onto this planet, fully formed artists, you know. I don't know whatever happened to any of those guys, but I know for sure I haven't heard any of their names, you know. And I think that if you're ever in a room and there's ever any somebody who's telling you, you know, this is how you do it or this is what you do, and they're acting like they have all the answers, that is the one person who absolutely does not have all the answers because they're not even smart enough to know what they don't know. And in terms of art, whether it's writing or music or painting or whatever, like, it's art. It's unknowable. There are no answers. You're never going to have all the answers. And so whenever you meet somebody that acts like they got all this figured out, either it's a complete affectation or they are just completely clueless because those people don't exist.
Yeah, so F you guys. And my other question then, based on all this.
But what I'm saying is you need to be critical of your own stuff.
You're a very humble guy, and I really much appreciate
that. No, but if you're not critical of your own stuff, and if you're not like – and I'm not trying to say you're going to sit around and just mope all the time, and I'm a tortured writer, whatever. But you need to look at your work, and you need to always say, I could have done this better. You need to always say, I could have done this better, you know, because if you don't, you stop growing as a writer, and then you're toast, you know. I mean – that's the end.
So as a humble guy, like I say, I appreciate that. You must get it at conventions and such and in different places on occasion. If you do book signings or whatever, you must hear people come up to you and go, I'm a big fan of you. Is that still surreal to hear? How is that to hear? I'm used to hearing it myself all the time. But for you.
Yeah, I mean, it is completely surreal, you know. I don't know. Whenever somebody comes up and wants me to sign something, they say they like their story, my story or whatever. Every time, it's like the best time you've ever heard it, you know, because, it, you know, you're only as good as your latest book. And I was talking to somebody I know who's a musician, and they were talking about a CD launch and how you've been working in the studio for this album for a year. And you've been, you know, it comes out and the first single is going to be on the radio. And just all the tense pressure and the, oh my God, I hope this single lands because if it doesn't, you know, we're done for, whatever. And I was like, that's what writing comics is like, but you got to do that every month, you know. And if you're writing more than one book, you got to do that as many books as you have a month because you're only as good as your latest book. That's all the people remember of you is your latest book. And so now that I'm doing monthly comics and, you know, between EXO and Demon Knights and Green Lantern, they all come out on different Wednesdays, three Wednesdays a month now, I've got a new book. It's like this roller coaster of, oh, they liked it. I'm so happy they liked it. And down to, oh my God, I hope they like the next one. You know, it's just that never ending. Duh, 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 duh. And so whenever I meet somebody and they say they like the story or they still like the story or whatever have you, it's always just a huge relief, you know?
And you know who always, his next book is always good, is Van Lent. That guy's,
That's what I've heard. I've heard that Archer and Armstrong is like the best series.
Oh,
like
way better. Oh, man.
The next
panel, so
way better than Green Lantern. It's better than everything, you know? Everything. Yeah.
All right. RobertVenditti.com, your website, one more time. And Brett, you have any final thoughts? And then we'll let the big guy go out and he can say the final words to our listeners.
No, I'm totally going to take Columbo over here away and stop him from coming back in and asking more questions.
Just one more question. Just one more thing.
Thanks so much, Robert. We appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it, guys.
All right. Once again, thank you very much to Robert. He was great. Rob, I know we're going to talk to him again in the future. He basically told us he wants us to. So that's nice of him. So really, really good. Gave us an awful lot of time. And like you say, we kind of went through his whole career there. But you're going to hear a lot more from him in the near future. Who wants to hit some reviews?
Just one note. That whole interview, guys, nobody said no more Ninjak. What the hell? You had an opportunity
Chris.
We asked him for more Ninjak.
You did talk about Ninjak. You didn't say stop this.
But Chris, we did say there's a guy on our podcast who hates Ninjak. We did say to him. And,